Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 065294, Role Models America, Inc., Appellant versus Pete Garrett, Secretary of the Army et al. Mr. Nath for the appellant, Mr. Baldrick for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal. Let me first address the issue of mootness that's been raised by the government this week. Our client, Role Models America, a nonprofit group, continues to seek property at Fort Ritchie as part of its Role Models Academy, which is designed to give out-of-school youth, including homeless youth, a second chance in life and an opportunity to earn a high school certificate or degree and an opportunity to attend college. The case is not moot. While certain transfers have been taking place over the last few months, the law is clear, black letter law from the Supreme Court, that a defendant with notice in an injunction proceeding, if they complete the acts sought to be enjoined, the court may, by mandatory injunction, restore the status quo. We've cited a number of cases in our opposition to the government's suggestion in which courts did declare real estate transfers void. Those transfers can be undone. The government and PMDC and COPT proceeded in this case with full knowledge of RMA's claims and proceeded to transfer the property in any event. By doing so, they did not deprive this court of the power to grant meaningful relief to RMA. So in our view, the case is not moot. Unless you have any other questions on that, I'll proceed to the merits. The court below committed two fundamental errors in dismissing RMA's claims for lack of standing. First of all, the district court found that Role Models was not a homeless provider, in quotes, and therefore lacked standing to challenge or to submit a notice of interest for use of this property for homeless purposes. That clearly is not the law. There's nothing in the statute that says a entity is either a homeless provider or an educational provider, and yet that was the district court's approach. Role Models either has to be an educational provider or a homeless provider, but can't be both. But what the statute refers to is that entities can both submit notices of interest for homeless use of property and can also submit applications for use of property as a public benefit conveyance, including educational use. And HUD regulations, which...
When you had the chance to apply as a homeless provider on the first go-around, why didn't you?
Well, in the first go-around, you mean back in 1996? Right. Role Models wasn't even aware of the notice at that point. Mm-hmm. It didn't become aware of the availability of the property until after the homeless submission had already expired.
But there was no notice to homeless providers back then.
There was a notice to homeless providers back in 1996, but there was no notice for use of the property for other purposes, including educational benefits or public benefit conveyances.
That was your claim the first time around, and then after the first decision, you're now saying you're a homeless provider, but that was never argued. When was the first time you said you were a homeless provider?
Well, Your Honor, first, in terms of being a homeless provider or not a homeless provider, it's our position that...
Right. I know you don't like the terminology, but
right.
Were you indicated anything about homeless services?
Well, RMA has always provided homeless services. I think the first time it raised...
indicated in this litigation?
In the litigation, I believe it was 2005, mm-hmm. Before HUD approved the redevelopment plan, which is part of the statutory procedure. RMA raised the issue that the notices... or that on remand, that the government had failed to screen for both homeless use and public benefit conveyances simultaneously. So that was raised before HUD approval of the redevelopment plan. So it's our position that entities clearly can submit notices of interest for both homeless purposes and public benefit conveyances. And in fact, if you use the district court's logic, no entity that provides homeless services could ever also submit a dual notice of interest for homeless purposes, and vice versa. If you provide homeless services, you couldn't. Because according to the district court, you're either a homeless provider or an educational provider. And so it said Role Models is an quote-unquote educational provider and therefore cannot be a quote-unquote homeless provider. But the statute talks in terms of...
The district court was referring to what you had said.
No, I don't believe we ever used the term, Your Honor. We never...
The term. Again, your argument the first time around.
Right. The argument the first time around, when the litigation began in 2001, was that there was no screening for public benefit conveyances, because that clearly was absent. So that properly was the focus of the first litigation, the first round of litigation. But then this court remanded it to the district court with instructions to remedy the procedural defects that had been identified. It's our position that in going back and remanding the case, the government could not then introduce new defects in the process. And so that if you have to screen for public benefit conveyances and homeless purposes simultaneously on remand, what the government should have done was to conduct a proper screening and to screen for both simultaneously, giving Role Models America and other groups the opportunity to submit dual notices of interest. And in fact, that's exactly what the government did initially. In their first advertisement for property, they advertised both for homeless purposes and for public benefit conveyances. For some reason, they retracted that ad and then limited the remand to public benefit conveyances.
What's the source of the simultaneous requirement?
A number. First of all, if you look at the statute talks about a process in which property is declared surplus and then it's advertised for use for both homeless purposes and public benefit conveyances. When you read the statute, it's clear that these processes take place at the same time. The court, in its earlier decision, I think properly and correctly echoed the statutory framework when it talked about simultaneous screening proceeding in parallel, meanwhile, while one proceeds, the other proceeds, exactly how you would interpret the statute, that these two should run simultaneously. There's an email which is in the record.
Doesn't the reg speak in terms of the time period?
Yes, Your Honor, that's another point. The regulation talks about not different time periods, but the time period in which an advertisement should be placed and property made available. This is all confirmed by an email from...
Let me go back to,
yes,
to something Judge Kavanaugh was asking. You understand our skepticism, don't you, about you claiming that you are a provider for the homeless. You understand that, don't you? I mean, the first time you had a chance and you didn't bring forth yourself as someone who's a provider for the homeless, and it's only recently that you've done that. What are we to make of that?
Well, if you look at the record, you'll see that, number one, Role Models program has always been described as a program to benefit out-of-school youth, and out-of-school youth include homeless youth. So that's always been part of the program. You'll see also in the record that back in 1999, Role Models submitted notices of interest for another property, Sheltenham, in the Washington, D.C. area, and there they had both homeless and public benefit components to that program. So Role Models has always provided services to the homeless. In the earlier litigation, the focus was on the defects.
You had a chance to do so here. Earlier, you didn't. It has the flavor of sort of a last-ditch effort to find something amiss with what the Army's done. And you had a chance to provide notice as a homeless provider. You didn't.
Right. So let me try and clarify. Back in 1996, there was a homeless screening process. That was almost 10 years before this plan was submitted to HUD. That screening process closed. Then there was an educational benefit process, but no one received notice of the educational process. Okay, so when Role Models filed its first complaint in 2001, it focused not on the homeless screening, which had closed long ago, but on the educational component as to which it never had notice. That does not mean that if a proper screening process was conducted on remand, Role Models could not submit dual notice of interest for both homeless and educational purposes. That just means that the focus on the earlier litigation was on the educational benefit, because that's the component as to which Role Models never received any notice.
I'm just absolutely baffled at your claim here. I don't understand it. You submitted material to the government that described exactly what Role Models does, right? And the government was not misled. The government understood entirely everything that Role Models, whether you call it homeless or whether you call it educational or a combination, doesn't matter. And you were rejected. right? And there's no claim that I see here that the government did anything wrong in not giving you this property, except for this notice thing. But you were rejected. So, you know, what's your argument that somehow or another, had you been put in one category or another, things would have changed? It wouldn't have changed. The government knew exactly what you did.
Well, there are two, although parallel processes, they are different processes with different criteria. There are criteria for homeless notice of interests, and there are criteria for public benefit conveyances. And under the homeless provisions, entities are entitled to property at no cost. And one of the pretexts, we believe it was a pretext, for denying Role Model's public benefit conveyance application was that it lacked financial resources. However, if it had been entitled to apply for a homeless conveyance, that wouldn't have been an issue because those are no-cost conveyances. So it does make a difference, Your Honor.
But entitled to apply, you could have applied. Nobody stopped you from applying, you know, for the homeless thing. That's what my colleagues have just asked you. You just didn't do it. So, you know, what's the point?
Okay, and if I was unclear, let me clarify. After remand, after this court found that the notice was defective, there was no opportunity for Role Models to submit a homeless notice.
What about before remand?
Right, that was long ago. That was the notice period had closed in 1996. Okay. So when Role Models first became aware of this property and the availability to bid for the property, it was too late. As a matter of fact, in the record, and we've got a declaration from Dr. Alexander, when he first became aware of this Fort Ritchie property, he asked about homeless screening, and he was told the homeless screening had closed. So before the court's decision, there was no opportunity to submit a notice of interest.
Well, there was an opportunity. You just didn't take it. I mean, it's not the government's fault that you didn't have notice, because the notice for the homeless was totally proper.
Well, you asked why didn't Role Models apply, and that's why Role Models didn't apply.
Because
it wasn't
didn't
aware
know.
Back
well,
in 1996. And what we have by the failure to conduct...
Your theory is that the initial D.C. Circuit decision restarted the entire process.
It restarted at least the portion of the process dealing with the screening process, yes.
The entire screening process, not just part of the screening process.
Yes, exactly.
That's your theory.
Because otherwise you're piecemealing the process. Otherwise you've got HUD in 2005 considering a redevelopment plan, which is based on a 1996 homeless screening and a 2003 educational benefit screening. There's no way that HUD in 2005 could evaluate the needs of the homeless based on a screening process that had taken place in 1996. It's our position that those processes should have proceeded in parallel after the court's remand. Role Models should have had an opportunity to submit both dual notices of interest. There was no opportunity to do so after remand because the government retracted the ad that said the property was being made available for homeless purposes. And if I could, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, the government believes that the recent transfer of property mooted appellant's complaint because there's no federal action remaining and there's no effective relief to be granted. Even if the case were not moot, we believe the district court properly dismissed appellant's complaints here because the appellants lack standing to pursue their claims. Your Honor, the mootness issue before the court is important, and I think it's important at least to understand the procedural history a bit, because as appellants cite out, there is case law, Porter v. Lee and otherwise, that talks about the issue of course, under the equity powers of a court, the court has the power to return the status quo to things. But those cases and all those language, if you look at the cases cited, usually deal with circumstances where we're talking about the court's ability to preserve its power to hear a case, or so we're dealing with circumstances where there was no stay pending appeal requested, or there was a quick action that attempted to subvert the court's authority. And those are the cases where you see that equity power used. Here we face a far different scenario, where this court actually enjoined this action for several years, and there was a pending injunction for almost 4 years. And when it went back to the district court, and twice the government tried to remove that injunction, ultimately it was removed. And in addition to that, It came back to the court. The government waited until this court chose not to continue the injunction and didn't grant the order of a stay in that case. So in those circumstances where the injunction has been in place and when the court has heard the issue and chooses not to maintain the injunction, the case becomes moot. And none of the cases that appellants cite go contrary to that. In fact, this court has often held in the past that the general rule is once the action that sought to be enjoined is completed, that action is generally moot. Now, there are exceptions to that, but again, I think in this type of circumstance, it wouldn't be appropriate here. More to the point, I think even if not technically moot under the constitutional analysis, under prudential analysis, this court has also held previously and is well established that even if a case is not technically moot, if the issue is so attenuated, comity and respect and practical advice makes sense of respect to the other branches not to go ahead and undo a transaction like this.
They saw damages too, didn't they?
Yes, Your Honor. You're asking whether appellants in this case sought damages?
Right.
That is correct, Your Honor. They saw. Well,
why is that moot?
Your Honor, the issue is moot because there's questions whether the court could undo the transaction. The parties aren't all before you, at least in the role models case. So
no, but I'm asking you why the aspect of the case in which they sought damages is moot.
Your Honor, I would have to say the ability to kind of resolve the case is gone, and therefore you'd have a difficulty getting to that issue.
No, we resolve the case. We say the government's transfer was illegal because the government didn't do what the plaintiff says it should do, and therefore we award $40 million. Why is that moot?
So, Your Honor, if we remanded the case because we determined that
not remanded, well, yeah, we remanded for that,
and then the district court would then to go and determine that in fact we violated the procedures, and somehow that Role Models was entitled to the property, they could get damages. And I guess my best answer to that would be along the lines of what I tried to illuminate there: Chamber of Commerce versus Department of Energy, which is 627 Fed Second 289. Which is just in some circumstances, the issue is so attenuated that even if the court has the power to go back and decide the issue, it should stay its hand out of respect for the situation as is. And we've gone so far down the road at this point, Your Honor, it wouldn't make sense to go forward and do that now. In other words, when we got here and they raised their stay after the injunction was removed, everyone came before this court and made their arguments of why it is the injunction should either continue and the harm that existed from doing it. At that point, when we looked at the issue and decided that it wasn't worth keeping the stay, it was well understood the property would be transferred, and that's exactly what happened. Now, as it turns out, unfortunately for the oral argument schedules for everybody's sake, it happened much later in the process. The completion happened much later than we would have liked, but it was clear to everyone at the time that the order was not stayed and the injunction was removed that this case was going to be moved. Appellants had argued as much below when they sought the injunction in the first place. And I know they raised in their most recent reply that they're not stopped by estoppel, but estoppel is not the argument, Your Honor. The argument is the common sense of when the property is transferred from the government to another party and then from another party to a third party for development, it's too late to unring that bell.
Well, this case is different than the companion case because the parties to whom the land was transferred are not parties in this case. The other case, they are. So any order that we issued against the actual defendants would be in. The actual defendants can't do anything to grab the land back. I mean, what can they do? I mean, you know, nothing. So we don't have the proper parties before us to give an order that would unravel the transaction. But that's an argument you haven't made, right?
No, Your Honor, if I haven't made it, it's because I didn't make it articulately enough. That's my fault. That's absolutely the argument here.
Yeah.
There is a secondary issue which goes to, as you point out, in the Lemon Beiser case, which is the companion case that you are hearing today. Though they are parties to the case, although I would point out that there's a question of whether they're proper parties any longer. In other words, if the case were remanded back, initially they were parties under the Defense-Based Closure Realignment Act. The issues that appellants chose to raise were just the federal agency cases, the NEPA and the NHPA cases. And if you were to determine that they had standing and that case was remanded to the district court, it's not at all clear that those non-federal actors should be parties any longer to that suit because they have no bearing on the APA case, and they would no longer be proper parties to the case. And so I think there are still some issues with that. They didn't get to that stage procedurally because of the standing issue. But I think that very well they would no longer be parties any longer in the case, and that's kind of supported by several of these cases, including the Karst case, which talks about non-federal entities can't be forced to do anything under NEPA or the APA. Your Honor, returning to the argument here in the role models case, in the primary argument that essentially the role models lack standing because they by law of the case, were not a homeless provider, I think it's very clear. The one thing I'd like to point out is the Senior Resources versus Jackson case, which kind of actually specifically addressed the same type of scenario. Appellants would have you believe that the entire rescreening process must be done completely in its entirety if there's found to be some defect. And they do that notwithstanding the fact that their argument before this court when they came the first time was simply how could they possibly have had notice, because the notice went to homeless providers and they didn't do that type of thing. They were education providers. And based on that lack of notice is why this court remanded the case and gave them the second opportunity.
Was this a judgment on the pleadings?
Yes, Your Honor.
There was no discovery or factual development or anything?
That's correct.
The district court, the second time around, right?
The second time around, Your Honor, there was documents outside the pleadings that were included. In other words, there was affidavits in several documents.
Yeah, see, I have trouble putting this in the pigeonhole of standing, at least with respect to this notice claim. It just seems to me the district court, I'm looking at the opinion, it says, simply put, this court, only required the defendants to screen for other interested parties. It necessarily did not require the defendants to conduct both processes simultaneously. The plaintiff cannot demonstrate that defendants failed to comply with the act. Therefore, they have no standing. I mean, that sounds like a decision on the merits to me, you know, that they failed to state a cause of action. I don't see why it's standing.
Your Honor, I think the reason
they claim you have to do both at the same time. The district court says, no, you don't. Therefore, you don't have standing. Therefore, you lose, period. What's the standing question?
Your Honor, what the district court held is that by necessary implication of this circuit's holding is the appellant was not a homeless provider. And that was the only reason. In other words, the argument could have been made. They could have said, we were a homeless provider, and we missed that opportunity. But that wasn't the argument that was presented to the court. And it wasn't the argument the court accepted. In other words, the district court...
Well, suppose they were. Why does it matter? Under the district court's reasoning, it doesn't change a thing. Because the only thing that was remanded, the district court's reasoning is that the mandate required only screening for other interested persons. And even if they were a homeless provider, that's water over the dam or under the bridge or it's long gone, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Your Honor, I think that's correct. And in other words, I think you could certainly affirm for any other reason raised below or because there's a lack of ability for appellants to get their case heard. And I think that's where Senior Resources versus Jackson, I think, is an important case. Because that's
and on the on the National Historic Preservation Act claim, I think you maybe can put that into the category of standing, but it's prudential standing. It's not Article 3. It's that the statute, that the interest they're asserting is not within the zone of interest that the statute protects. That's basically what the district court said. They don't want to preserve the land. They want to occupy it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And as this court has held in Public Citizen, it's the appellant's burden to establish standing, and there needs to be some germaneness requirement that it needs to relate to the statute, and an economic interest simply isn't enough, is what the district court held. And I think that, again, given appellant's burden, they have done nothing to show that that's not true as an economic provider. Yeah. Unlike the Lemon Beiser case, which presents different challenges, the appellants here clearly are not the type of party that the NEPA Act
is. Who is the kind of party?
Your Honor,
just any citizen?
The citizens' interest group, organizational groups are clearly held to be proper parties, as well as citizens with close and necessary interest to it who can demonstrate some type of harm.
So if you go, a citizen who lives nearby can bring a Historic Preservation Act claim, right?
Your Honor, it goes a bit farther than that, I think, because you need to establish all the elements in standing. And they would have to still demonstrate there was some type of harm that was causally caused by the action they're bringing.
That's my question. Is the Lujan kind of analysis apply to Historic Preservation Act claim in your judgment and the government's view? Lujan explained that the causation and redressability were relaxed in procedural rights claims.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand the question. I guess if you're asking, are they relaxed, the answer is yes. Are they gone, the answer is no. And I think so that's the analysis. In other words, so I hesitate to say, and as the kind of the court has pointed out in national parks and other cases just recently, that, you know, to say, hesitate to say any citizen nearby has standing because that's too broad, and that's exactly what the court doesn't want to do to kind of get rid of the case and controversy requirements. So you have to flesh out what that means. Now, the standing requirements as presented in Lujan are different when it's a purely procedural issue, and I think under NHPA as well, that would be the case.
Any citizen nearby who has an interest in historic preservation?
And who can show some substantial likelihood of harm caused by the activity that they're alleging to have happened. So in other words, in this case,
if
you look at...
the harm is that the property is not being used for historic preservation.
Your Honor, but they have to have some type of... Yeah, I guess, I'm sorry to get too far. I feel that they have to allege that the harm that's happened is related to that. So, for example, if we switch gears to the Lemon Beiser, which I was trying not to do too much, but I'm happy to. In other words, there is a real question about whether or not an NHPA action would have any effect on a third-party landowner who has a separate obligation to do things. And so the issue of standing in that case, it's a bit different because there's an attenuation between what they're trying to accomplish via the government and the obligations of the third party. And the National Parks kind of talked about this analysis when they said, you know, typically in your typical procedural case, the party that's alleged to have kind of made the omission, the federal government agency, is the same one who's creating the action. And that's not the case that we have here. It's not clearly the case in national parks as well, which is why they kind of left it uncertain of whether it's a procedural or a substantive, and that's why the relaxation issues become a bit more vague, in my opinion, because it's hard to kind of nail that down. But I think it's certainly true that causation absolutely needs to be there, and you need to focus on the attenuation. And it's also true that to some extent of redressability is as well an issue. Your Honor, with regard to the role models, pending your questions, I have nothing further.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I guess you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have four brief points to make. First of all, the issue that the case was dismissed on was an issue of standing, and we think improperly so. The court said that role models, after remand from this court, had no right to submit a notice of interest for homeless purposes as part of the process, and therefore could not complain that there was no ability to screen for homeless purposes. That clearly is not the law. The HUD regulation says that any organization which provides or proposes to provide services to the homeless can submit a notice of interest for homeless purposes. You don't have to be a quote-unquote homeless provider. So clearly the whole basis for the court's decision was that role models had no right or ability to submit a notice of interest for homeless purposes, yet all it had to do was propose to provide services to the homeless and it would have been able to submit such a notice under HUD's own regulations. This is an issue of standing. The court erred in finding that role models had no standing on that basis. Second point, the government just argued that during the original proceedings before this court, role models argued that we don't do that type of thing relating to homeless services. That argument was not the argument that was made. The argument that was made was that there was no screening for public benefit conveyances. The argument was not that role models did not provide homeless services or doesn't provide services to the homeless. That was not the basis for role models' arguments 5 years ago, and it wasn't the basis for the court's decision. In addition, there are a number of other issues that were raised after remand, defects in the base closure process, which role models clearly had standing to raise. Those issues were never addressed by the district court because of its erroneous finding of standing. And I won't repeat them. There are four or five different arguments, all defects in the process that arose after the remand. Role Models was entitled to raise those. They did raise those through an amended complaint. They were never addressed by the district court. Finally, on the Historic Preservation Law Act, Role Models did previously occupy this property under a lease and use the property in a manner that was consistent with the historic use of the property. The current redevelopment plan proposes to tear down those historic properties and erect high-rise office buildings. Clearly, we think that Role Models would, under those circumstances, be within the zone of interest the statute was meant to protect and have standing to raise its claims under the historic preservation laws as well as the base closure act. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.